welcome to The Spectator Podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. As the Supreme Court wraps up its trial looking into the prorogation of Parliament, we ask, are the courts overreaching? We also discuss the prevalence of mental illness amongst the homeless. And finally, Mary Killen tells us why she's no longer a Remainer. This week sees the end of an extraordinary Supreme Court trial. A former Prime Minister made a damning statement against our current Prime Minister. Meanwhile, allies of the government have questioned the impartiality of the judiciary. It's all getting a bit political. So, what should the role of the judiciary be in a democracy? And are our courts overmighty? Richard Eakins, head of the Judicial Power Project at Policy Exchange, raises these questions in this week's cover article, and he joins us down the line from Oxford. I'm also joined by Jack Simpson-Caird, a constitutional law expert from the Bingham Centre. Jack, for those listeners who might not have been following this week's events all that closely, can you give us a bit of an overview into what's been happening and what's at stake for the government?
Okay, so what we've seen is the Miller challenge setting out their arguments, and essentially their argument is that the prorogation requested by the Prime Minister was unlawful because essentially it didn't take into account Parliament's constitutional role. It misunderstood Parliament's constitutional role, and as a result, the prorogation should be declared by the court unlawful. Then we've heard from the government that actually the court shouldn't even be looking at this question, that actually the question of prorogation is something which is subject to convention, and in our system that means that the courts don't play a role at all.
Richard, you write in your cover piece this week that this is a classic example of judicial overreach. Why exactly do you say that?
Well, it's not overreach yet insofar as the court hasn't ruled. The Scottish Court of Session's judgment, I think, was deeply problematic, and I hope the Supreme Court will reverse it. But the whole episode, I think, shows a wider trend, which is a willingness to have recourse to the courts to try to secure a political advantage which you haven't yet managed through the democratic process. And the power to prorogue Parliament is one that in our constitution has been traditionally subject to political controls. It's the case here and elsewhere in the common law Westminster world. And so the attempt to get a legal control on it is, I think, an attempt to get an advantage by way of unusual, unorthodox legal process.
And Jack, what are the likely outcomes that we're going to see? What are the various things that might happen at the end of the trial?
I think it's a bit of a mugged game trying to sort of predict what might happen. I think from my perspective, I'm a bit more comfortable with the role of the courts playing than Richard is. And for one reason mainly is that I think we need some interpretive clarity of what our constitution says in this situation. I think it's right that the prorogation has given rise to a really difficult legal question. And the reason we have a Supreme Court is to decide those difficult questions one way or another. And I'm really hoping that whatever the judgment is, either way it goes, that it offers some interpretive clarity so that then Parliament and the government can say, OK, well, we know what to do next.
Richard, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I don't think it was a difficult legal question, actually. I think it was pretty clear that the power to prorogue is not subject to judicial review. And that was the position taken by the High Court, a very strong High Court with the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales. And I think that judgment should be upheld by the Supreme Court. And I mean, to the extent there is a lack of clarity, it's because of this litigation trying to introduce uncertainty. And I think if the Supreme Court can uphold the High Court, it'll have done a good service. I'm not sure it will, but wait and see.
Jack, do you think it's fair to say that our courts are becoming more political?
I'm not sure that's right. I think that in a sort of constitutional situation that we're in, where there's actually fundamental conflict going on between government and parliament and the normal rules don't seem to apply, I think it's far from unusual that in that situation, in a constitutional democracy, that you get these questions raised in court. I think there is a sense that the prorogation, there was a sense of sort of perhaps Richard would say something that's politically unfair. But I think there is also a sense that it trespasses into constitutional territory because it does sort of challenge existing understandings of what Parliament's role is. The fact is that the government didn't think that they could necessarily win a motion for a conference recess. And so they essentially circumvented a choice that Parliament would ever have to make. Now, there's a lot of people that think that that sort of circumvention isn't in keeping with our constitutional arrangements, where you need to get a majority for the things that you want to do. And sort of getting around a requirement for a majority feels sort of out of step with our constitution. And I think there are some people, of which I'm probably one, who would say that part of the role of the court in this context is to look at our constitutional rules and practices and to sort of look at them in the context of what's actually going on in the constitution, not just in sort of abstract to say, you know, we shouldn't get involved because this is a matter for politics. Actually look at what's going on in the constitution and take a judgment based on that.
Richard, you also talk in your piece about how normally in these circumstances there'd be an election called. I assume that's because the Fixed Term Parliament Act isn't allowing it. Do you think that that piece of legislation is causing quite a lot of problems here as well?
No, I certainly do. It's not just the legislation. We've got a very odd situation in which a majority in the House of Commons is willing to legislate to force the government to violate its central policy, but is not willing to withdraw confidence or otherwise to make an election possible. I think that is unconstitutional, and the House of Commons should change its mend its ways in that respect. But I think there is a mistake. It's a mistake with respect to suggest that if a course of action is politically controversial, if you can accuse the government of acting in some way unconstitutionally, it follows that the courts should leap in and try to put it right. And I think that's part of the narrative that's going on that encourages this litigation, namely that we look to the courts as the guardians of the Constitution. And that's not our tradition at all. The courts have got a vital role to play in upholding the law, and if there's settled constitutional law, of course they should enforce it. But they don't have a sort of roving jurisdiction to interfere, to extend the reach of the law in order to make the Constitution work better, partly because how it should be working is deeply controversial. And I think it's not good for either the rule of law or for the political constitution, for the integrity of the democratic process, if they do intervene in that way.
I think that's interesting, but I disagree, Richard, on both those points. In relation to the second point, I think that the court here, we shouldn't get the idea that the courts are somehow trying to intervene or govern or usurp Parliament's role. What they're really, whatever they decide, either way, I think there's a good chance that Parliament will look to legislate to regulate the power of prorogation in some form or another in the future, because the situation that we've seen has been so out of step with our, sort of how people understand the Constitution as it should work. And in relation to Richard's point about the Commons, I think that you can flip that on its head. Arguably, what's going on, what's strange here, is that the government is willingly entering into a conflict with a majority of MPs. Normally what happens is that the government only proposes things that it knows it can get a majority for. It's not the normal course of events for a government to put forward proposals which it knows it has a majority, and then neither to resign or call an election when it doesn't get its policy through.
Well, it did try to call an election, and the House of Commons refused. So we are in an odd position there. But partly the fact that this is a political controversy that is open to sort of hot tempers on both sides is a very good reason, I think, why the courts should not be intervening effectively on one side of a controversy.
Jack, it does seem as if a lot of the people involved in pushing for this court case also don't want Brexit to happen. I mean, do you think that is obviously a big part of all of this as well?
I mean, I don't think it's for me to look at the motives underlying it. I do think that what we've seen this week is that the disagreement over how our constitution should work is pretty fundamental and goes much beyond the issue of whether or not we should be a member of the EU. You've got one vision where you see the role of Parliament as sort of, in a sense, sort of subservient to good government, and then another where Parliament and the courts should play a role in checking and holding the government to account. And there is a real clash. Some people characterise this as the Whitehall view on the one hand and the Westminster view on the other. And it depends where you stand. Are you someone who thinks that Parliament is the central governing institution of our constitution, or is it actually government? And I think that that's really what we see playing out here.
And just finally, what do you both think can be done to improve the situation? It's obviously got a bit difficult for everyone involved.
Well, maybe I'll go first. I think the Supreme Court should uphold the High Court's judgment, should make clear this is not a justiciable matter, it's not a matter for the courts, and leave it to the political process. More generally, I think we need to have our courts step away from the idea that they are there to be the guardians of the Constitution. They've got a vital role in relation to the rule of law, but that doesn't extend to that idea shouldn't be understood as sort of a reason to increase judicial interference more generally. There are other problems with the Constitution, or at least with the way our politics are playing out in the Constitution, but that's not a reason for the courts to somehow refashion their role in the scheme of things.
Well, I think that no one would doubt that the Supreme Court is an independent court and that under our system it plays a role in interpreting the law. That where I disagree with Richard is I think whichever way the court makes its decision, whichever decision it makes, that will not be the end of the matter. That won't be them settling the decision of the prorogation. It will be then over to Parliament to decide. So in that sense, I'm much more comfortable with the idea that the courts can play a sort of a complementary role with the other elements of our constitutional system.
Thank you, Jack and Richard.
Hello, I'm Isabel Hardman.
Hello, I'm James Forsyth.
And I'm Katie Balls, and you can join us all every day for Coffee House Shots, our daily politics podcast. Just search on the iTunes store or an alternative phone provider, and why not leave us a review if you like it?
If you live in London, you might have seen them. Rough sleepers who are clearly suffering from some form of mental illness or psychosis. These days, we talk about mental health a lot, perhaps more than ever before. But are we talking about it enough when it comes to the homeless and the rough sleeping? Mary Wakefield asked the question in this week's issue, and she joins me now, together with Dominic Williamson, Executive Director of Strategy and Policy from the homeless charity St Mungo's. Mary, your column this week asked the question, have you heard the screaming in the street? Who is it exactly that you're hearing screaming?
Well, I mean, I'm sort of probably late to notice, but it strikes me that we talk an awful lot about the mental health of more fortunate people, anxiety in the young and stress amongst the middle classes. But there are these homeless people on the street who are quite obviously suffering from significant mental health problems. And my column is really asking people why we don't discuss this more. And Dominic's in a position to tell us more about it.
Dominic, how prevalent is mental illness amongst the homeless?
So the best data that we have suggests that about 4 in 10 of the people sleeping rough have got some sort of mental health need. And when you actually just look at the people from the UK, it goes up from that. So it's a big proportion of people who are on the streets that we know about.
Dominic, could I just ask you, what does that signify? So a lot of people who came here looking for work are that the prevalence of mental illness is not as high, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're talking about people who are UK citizens who are sleeping on the rough. The proportion of that group with mental health is higher.
Does that suggest, I mean, I know it's very hard to say which came first, you know, the homelessness or the mental health problem, but does that suggest that the mental health issue is pre-existing their rough sleeping?
Like you said, it's a complex issue. So it's definitely the case that people's mental health is tied in with lots of other issues they might be facing. But certainly once you're on the street, your mental health is very likely to deteriorate. With lots of people, the mental health is part of the background that may have led them to be vulnerable to homelessness in the first place. And that's particularly the case where you're talking about somebody who has also got a drug or alcohol problem. And that whole sort of mix of complex needs that people end up with. But definitely being on the streets makes all of that a lot worse.
Yes. I mean, talking to some people, you know, with addiction problems, it seems to me extremely easy to understand how they've got that way. Life is so complicated and the stresses are so great. I would defy any of us to say we wouldn't self-medicate in their situation just to feel better.
Well, yes. I mean, I think once you start to hear the life stories of the people we're talking about, then it starts to make sense. So people don't suddenly appear on the streets with a mental health problem, a drug and alcohol problem. It's the end result of a whole series of, you know, as you say in your article, when you start looking back at people where they've had a pretty dreadful start in life, and they haven't managed to get the sort of help that might have given them some resilience along the way, then it's not surprising that people end up in that situation. I guess one of the things I wanted to say was that there's some of the things that can help and protect people from ending up in that situation have got less available, and it's more difficult to access than it certainly was. So we have got a situation where some of the services that people may have been able to turn to in the past are not available.
Do you mean because of universal credit and, you know, accessing welfare and stuff like that, or just because of cuts to local services?
So that's certainly part of the picture that can add pressure and make things difficult. I mean, we published, St Mungo's published research a few months ago that showed that funding for the kind of support services that protect vulnerable people that are already in accommodation and sort of help people once they're moving on from homelessness, the money that goes through local authorities to those services has been cut by about £1 billion a year over the last 10 years. So there's a really significant amount of money has come out of the kind of support services that really would protect people, which is why I think, you know, everybody has seen an increase over the last few years of people in that sort of situation on the streets.
I would think I was reading in St Mungo's information that it's tripled over the last 5 years, the rate of diagnosed mental illness amongst rough sleepers. But that could be just a result of people better diagnosing them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, homelessness and rough sleeping itself has gone up. I think in some places we're able to reach people and therefore know a little bit more about them. We have got some, there is some good news in that the government have recognised that more needs to be done on this, and in the NHS long-term plan there was a commitment to put some specialist services in for people sleeping rough, and we've been working with the department to try and shape what that looks like. So I think one of the really important things to understand is with the right support, even though the people who are in that terrible situation you've recognised and talked about, with the right sort of combination of services and support and treatment, people can be helped to get back on their feet. So it's not people are not a lost cause, even in the situations you describe in your article, if the right sort of combination of help and treatment is there.
So you can, even people who are resisting diagnosis and saying there's nothing wrong with me, sort of in the grip of paranoia, with the right specialist support, you can get them back into a position where they might take medication or something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we run a service in Bristol, which works in the community, where part of the service is to really start to build those trusting relationships with people who might be even resistant to getting services. And it's been very successful in making sure that people do then access the kind of treatment, which might be, people might need psychological therapy, there might be medicine that could help. Certainly people need stable housing, and that's one of the kind of absolutely essential parts of the package that people need. You can't treat somebody effectively if they're sleeping on the street, so you need somewhere appropriate housing to bring people into when you do provide the rest of the package that people need.
We've written before about the sort of Housing First programme, and you guys think that's a good idea, right, where you put someone in a house first and then treat their addiction simultaneously. You don't require them to be clean before you find accommodation.
So Housing First is a model which can be great for some people, and we've got some Housing First services that are doing really well for people. Some people that really suits, other people need really to be in a place where there's actually sort of 24-hour staff and that kind of thing, so more of a sort of supported housing situation. So it does depend on the individual, but certainly Housing First is one good model. But the thing with that is you have to make sure that the mental health and the drug and alcohol treatment services are tied into that. I mean, there's Housing First pilots that are happening at the moment, and it will be interesting to see how that bit of the picture is working.
Dominic, one of the points that Mary also makes is that it can be obviously quite intimidating for people who might want to help homeless people, but it's dealing with someone who is schizophrenic or has mental health issues. What advice do St Mungo's give to people on how to help people who have mental health issues who are living homelessness?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that people can do is make sure that if they see somebody sleeping rough, then they can use, there's a service called StreetLink, which there's an app that you can get onto your phone, or you can phone the service. And what that does is if you let StreetLink know where the person's sleeping, and StreetLink service will inform the local outreach team. The outreach team will then go and try and find that person and try and start that process of understanding what they need and helping them get inside. So that's a really important message that people can use across England. You can use the StreetLink app to make sure that people know that somebody's there. I guess the other thing is, if you see someone who is a danger to themselves or other people and you're really worried about them, then phone 999. We do have a health service that will come and check the person's okay. So, and I know it's, we often don't know what to do, but if someone's behaving in a way that evidently is a danger to themselves or to other people, whether that person's homeless or not, then we do have services that ought to kick in that situation. So, get an ambulance.
Yes. Although you don't necessarily want these people ending up as part of what Tom Windsor describes as the prison full of chronic mental health problems. You don't want to channel, street homeless with mental health problems into prisons or hospitals necessarily, do you?
No. Well, there's quite a high proportion of people coming out of prison who end up homeless, sadly. It's in a way that the issues are very kind of connected. People, particularly those on short prison sentences, that might be, their offending might be related to sort of acquisitive crime because of a drug or alcohol issue, or shoplifting, or those sort of offences. you know, very often that's again a symptom of that kind of complex combination of problems that the person's dealing with. It's really important that we have a route when people do come out of prison that they're not released and then just left to go back on the street. And at the moment, too many people are in that situation.
Yeah, very good points. Although it might seem expensive, all this specialist early intervention. In fact, at the end of the day, it's going to save money, prison system money, save the NHS money.
Thank you, Mary and Dominic.
Hello, I'm Olivia Potts and I'm Spectator Life's vintage chef, and I'm here to tell you about the new Spectator Life website, where you can find articles on food and drink, travel, fashion, theatre, cinema and so much more. And you can also find all the Table Talk podcasts, where Lara Prendergast and I talk to notable people about their life through food. Just go to life.spectator.co.uk.
And finally, if there's a second referendum, have enough people changed their minds that would mean the result could be any different? Mary Killen, our Dear Mary columnist, has certainly changed her mind. In this week's issue, she writes about her journey from Leave to Remain to no-deal Brexiteer. She joins me now to tell us more, together with Rachel Johnson, journalist and former MEP candidate for Change UK. Mary, can you start by telling us about your journey from Leave to Remain to no-deal Brexiteer?
It was mainly about the silly laws for the farmers, which we live in the middle of a farming community, and there were things like a lamb had to have an electronic tag in its ear, which would cost more than what the farmer would get for the lamb when he sold it, things like that. And I felt it was a bit of a gravy train, and generally suspicious of what was going on there. I thought it was, you know, the expenses and everything. And then, once I was talked to by people who knew more than I did, I realised it would be a massive own goal to leave, because we'd all got on so well. In fact, the EU was nominated as a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize at one stage, because we hadn't had a war in Europe for so long. Plus, I wanted to carry on travelling through the Eurozone, and I realised there were many advantages which outweighed the disadvantages. However, as the months rolled on and people got more and more full of hatred towards each other and we divided into these almost sectarian groups, I thought this has got to stop, and no deal Brexit is the only option, because Brussels won't move on Mrs. May's deal. We can't accept it, as it's worse than staying in. And we can't have a second referendum, as there'd be more tribal hatred of the Remains against the Leaves.
Rachel, do you have much sympathy with people who find their views shifting on the issue of Brexit?
I have complete sympathy with everybody on this issue, because, no, you know, we've got to recognise that before 2016, June hove into sight, we were all, like Mary, well, most of us were in two minds about it, because both sides had good arguments and it was hard to judge between them. You know, we were given actually a very short time to pronounce on an issue of enormous importance and in a very binary way. Therefore, I don't like the anger. And I think Mary's comparison of what's happened to the country is to the Troubles is a worrying one, because one wonders, if it's not sorted and it's not done, where will it end? And will you have Leavers and Remainers fighting themselves in the street and booby-trapping border posts? I mean, it seems inconceivable, but, you know, wars have erupted over less.
And also, on the way here, a man I know who's a social figure said that...
Nicky Haslam.
No, it wasn't him. He said something that made me think. He said, what people feel about Brexit is representative of how they feel about themselves. People want the option, which means change, and that offers hope. And so even if they don't know what the change could bring, they feel it must be better than what they've got at the moment. I'm sorry, but the Remainers
They like things as they are.
Remainers are quite happy. Things are going well for them.
Well, that's what everyone teased me about when I joined Change UK, when everyone said with some justification, the one policy your party has is for everything to stay the same.
Yeah. Yes, well, it suited us, you see, but outside the M25, people were really miserable about it, you know, because they felt that they'd been swamped.
Yes, okay, but you've raised a really important thing, which was the referendum was a solution to a non-existent problem.
Yes.
So therefore, when you were offered a solution to your, as it were, problems, you said, yes, I'll have the solution. If this is going to make things better, and I believe the Leave side, when they say it's the easiest deal in human history, no downside, only upside, 350 million to the NHS, I'll take it. Okay. If you're a Remainer, you know, you're sitting quite pretty anyway, you've benefited from mass immigration, your mother's being looked after in her care home, you've had a lovely Slovakian au pair, and
a second home.
And a second home, and you like to, which you like to travel to in Italy, then you don't want things to change.
No.
So I think David Cameron has a very good line in his memoirs about what actually happened with the referendum, which was something like, when you address an emotional argument with a rational one, you get political chaos. So the Leavers had an emotional argument, the Remainers had an economic, rational one, and the result is we are all in chaos.
And we've been driven apart like we were in Northern Ireland and in Rwanda, where we suddenly think, oh, we're on that side then, and they must be the enemy, the other side. Around us in Wiltshire, there's a man who cuts down trees, and he's got a group of other men who are going to block the motorways if Brexit doesn't go through. They're so angry.
But what are they angry about? What do they want?
He's angry because when he goes to the doctor, he has to queue behind immigrants. That's his problem.
But if Brexit won't address that problem,
I know.
Because the great unspoken truth of Brexit is you'll get more brown immigration and less white immigration. Nobody has dared say that.
Yes, they don't realise that. They think all the immigrants will go on the 31st of October. They'll wave goodbye at Dover and off they'll go.
I'm disappointed.
They don't realise there'll be a similar influx coming in from the non-EU countries.
Mary, do you think it's socially unacceptable to reveal yourself to be a Brexiteer?
Well, it's becoming socially unacceptable. In fact, most dinner parties I've been to recently, the host has said, no, we're not going there. No one's allowed to discuss it. And even my hairdresser yesterday said she has banned it in the salon because she said it's like World War III if you get two in different chairs of opposing views. She said they get so angry.
But who would have ever thought that Britain, which, you know, not a particularly political country, and in all the polls running up to all general elections up till about 2015, Europe polled around 12th in for voter saliency and what people actually cared about. The EU never, ever turned up. And now we're at point of fisticuffs with each other.
You see, I think there's something dormant in us, a savagery that can be woken up and make us hate.
Do you think we want to hate? Do you think this is?
I think we've been tormented.
But as the etiquette expert of the Spectator, I mean, do you think that the Brexit? I mean, I think it's like a steroid on a malignancy. It's kind of entered the body politic like a steroid, and every little miserable little niggle and gripe people had has been amplified and fed by Brexit. But you know. Therefore, what's the answer? Do you have chemo? Do we have surgery? How do we get rid of this malignancy?
Cut it off as soon as possible with a no-deal Brexit and then no one can complain anymore.
But Mary, you know and I know that a no-deal Brexit means...
disaster.
We don't have a trading relationship or legal agreements and contracts, and 800 of them, with the block on our doorstep. And I think it was me who said that thing about the taking the fresh egg out of the baked cake.
Oh, was it?
That's why it's so difficult to do it after 40 years. It's like...
I know, but their blood is up now, the Brexiters, and they
Yes, but okay, but I'm sorry, just to finish my thoughts. So that's what happens. And then all you do is you go back to the EU with your tail between your legs, with your back broken and your wing down, and you say, well, now can we start again? 3 years down the line.
Yes,
so you might as well get a deal now, get it done. I think the Theresa May's deal was obviously worse than being in, because everything's worse than being in my book. So we've got to get some sort of deal in which you can just say to people, we've left.
Yeah.
Leave it at that. Send them a blue passport. Send them the Brexit 50p. Say it's happened and life can go on.
Yes. Yes.
And what about a second referendum, Rachel? Because the parties that you've been involved in, Change UK and the Lib Dems, have both been very pro-second referendum. What, I mean, do you think that could help solve
the issue? Permission to name drop. I was talking to Tony Blair about this last week, and he still thinks that a second referendum is, in terms of a plebiscitary event, the only way you can address Brexit, because a general election is much more multifaceted, multidimensional. And if it's a single issue like Brexit, it has to be sorted out in a referendum as it arose in a referendum as well. There has to be some symmetry. And a general election is not the way to decide Brexit. It didn't work in 2017. It's not going to work again. I disagree with him on a referendum, a second referendum, or some people call it a third, because I just see it. I just see endless Groundhog Day with it. We just divide the country again, quite narrowly. Potentially, you have Leave at 48 and Remain at 52, but I don't necessarily buy that. You can't change the terms of the referendum. That's the problem. You can't have a three-way referendum, I think. I think it'd be really hard to get that past the Electoral Commission. An idea he had, which I have put to the powers that be, is that we have a general election and a referendum on the same day. Therefore, the referendum result has to be executed by the winning party. Okay? So, assuming it's the Tory government led by Boris Johnson and Remain wins, well, then maybe Boris has to be Prime Minister of a Remain country, which to me is not a bad outcome for the family.
That would be good. But of course, there's still Richard Dawkins' point that he, as a top intellectual, couldn't decide which way to vote.
But he's a Remainer mayor.
He's written an article saying, how could I possibly know? It's too much to ask me. Well, he might have come down as Remain, but his original thing was that he couldn't possibly, yeah. It would take too long for him to work out what was the best thing. So how could the average person like me
That's
decide?
Why it was a really, really foolish decision of David Cameron's to call a referendum.
Mm. Poor David Cameron.
And just finally, right, I mean, you talk about with your husband Giles the sort of disagreements, and Rachel, I'm not going to ask you to divulge too many family secrets, but do you think one of the worst things about Brexit is the kind of divisions that it's created within, you know,
oh yes, families? old friends. They can't be in the same room as each other. I won't say who, but lots of very good old friends now can't see each other anymore.
Do you think eventually they'll be on better terms?
Well, I think if we get it over and done with, there could be a thawing like in Northern Ireland. And, you know, they could be, what would they call, the Chuckle Brothers. You could have Chuckle Brothers again.
Do you think
again.
In time, in years to come, so I've got a friend called Donovan, who's one of his mother's Catholic and his father's Irish, and he comes from Belfast. And it was quite unusual, you know, for Donovan to come from both sides of that former sectarian divide. I think in years to come, people are going to be saying, yes, you know, Mark, his mother was a Brexit. His mother voted Leave and his father was a Remainer. And people look at Mark with amazement.
I wonder, you know, in 6 years' time, will people still think of themselves as Brexiteers and Remainers?
God, possibly. Please, I don't know.
Please, no. I think it'll all, once it's cut off, you know, like a terrible boil, lanced, then people get back to their ordinary lives because everyone's fed up with it.
We can definitely agree on that.
Thank you, Rachel and Mary. And that's it for this week. If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, why not check out our live recording of Sam Leith's Spectator Books podcast. He'll be interviewing Robert Harris, the best-selling author of Fatherland, Enigma and Pompeii, live in Westminster on the 23rd of October. The event is subscriber only, so if you want to get a ticket, just visit spectator.co.uk/Harris. If you aren't a subscriber, what are you waiting for? Get a subscription on spectator.co.uk/voucher and we'll also give you a free £20 Amazon voucher. And if you pick up this week's issue, you can read everything we've talked about, as well as Fraser Nelson's interview with David Cameron, Nick Robinson's diary where he wonders whether he's the next John Humphreys, and plenty more. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.